We're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Will Weber is on the board. Will Erskine booking the guests. In the newsroom, Diana Weeks and Dave Woodard. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will meet Premier Doug Ford this afternoon to discuss healthcare. Here's hoping they accomplish more than just talk. Here's Scott Thompson.
Yeah. It is 900 CHML. I'm Scott Thompson. Will Erskine bringing the guests in. Will Weber on the board. Feel free to jump into the fun. We would love to hear from you. Send us a note, Scott Thompson at 900CHML.com. All right, lots going on today, including the Prime Minister in Ontario not only making a housing announcement or a regurgitated housing announcement way back from the budget in Kitchener today, but also meeting with Doug Ford, Premier of Ontario, and apparently about health care. That's going to be a closed-door meeting. Apparently, there isn't any sort of question and answer or report meeting with reporters afterwards. So we're going to have to wait and see. That's coming up at about 4 o'clock this afternoon that the Premier and the Prime Minister are going to meet. So there you have it. So, you know, those pretty much the big stories of the day, other than Canadians are angry. And, you know, I've been reading some interesting articles on this, and we'll get somebody on this poll a little later on. I don't need to tell you what it's like. You know what it's like. But, you know, Canadians are known for being so polite and so, no, you go. No, no, you go. No, you first. No, you first. No, I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry. And now we're all angry, which is kind of an odd place to be at, considering we are, after all, Canada, eh? We'll talk about that coming up a little later on. As I mentioned, there was some news in regard to this meeting and some healthcare today. Let's play you some clips of there. Colin DeMello, our Queen's Park bureau chief, talking about what the Premier and the Prime Minister could possibly be meeting about today.
Right now, all the provinces get about $42 billion every year. The provinces want another roughly $30 billion to help pay for the additional costs of healthcare. I mean, I think we've seen over the last couple of years just how important the healthcare system is and how vulnerable the healthcare system can be as well.
All right, that's Colin DeMello, Queen's Park Bureau Chief, talking about what is happening. We're going to talk to him, touch base with him coming up in just a few minutes and get a little bit more expanded on this and what is going on in today's meeting. Also, Premier, before this meeting at noon today in the Kitchener-Waterloo area, talking about housing. Here's the first clip, Will, on the Prime Minister talking about housing and what needs to be done.
Over the past years and the past months, I've talked with many Canadians who are worried about being able to afford a place to live. This is as true for people looking to buy a home as for those who live in rental housing. We're seeing prices going up across the country. So we know we need to build supply and find innovative solutions. And that's what today's announcement is all about.
All right, talking about building 17,000 homes with $2 billion over the next 10 years across the country, and the Prime Minister adding this is no silver bullet.
Tackling housing affordability is a complex problem, and there is no one silver bullet. The fact is, simplistic solutions are simply not going to solve the problem. But announcements like today's move us all forward and give more people a place to call home and a real and fair chance at success.
All right, there you have it. What that means, what that translates to, your guess is as good as mine. At the end of the day, we are stuck because we have a very, very high demand for a housing and a very, very low supply. So how quickly can you build things? How quickly can you move people around? Again, I like healthcare. I think this is something we're going to be playing catch up with for an extended period of time, especially when you don't build. And I mean, building has been a bad word. Let's be honest. I mean, building has been a bad word unless it's some sort of environmental project. Environmentalists have spoke up against urban sprawl, stopping any new development in that direction. NIMBYism within the city limits. which is why they're asking the mayors, or the prime, the premier's asking to bring more power to the mayors. NIMBYism within the in the city limits has stopped proper inner development. So where we are, where we are, we're stuck with nobody's building anything. And now, and again, to me, this was just amazing in my time on the planet, that all four of the major political parties, whether you were Green, whether you were NDP, whether you were Liberal, whether you were Conservative, all now in the last election had hefty campaigns to build a million homes. Where was that thinking 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago? Right now, it appears we're just we're applying Band-Aids. All right. They're going to meet this afternoon, the premier and the prime minister, at about 4 o'clock this afternoon. Colin DeMello will give us an update on what all that will entail coming up moments from now. All right. Big day in Ontario. The prime minister in Kitchener, Waterloo area earlier today around the noon hour to talk about a housing strategy. And later on this afternoon, going to meet with Premier Doug Ford, hopefully in regard to health care, to get a little bit more light on what they will be talking about, what's on the agenda. Let's bring in Colin DeMello, Queen's Park Bureau Chief, Global News. He's with us now. Colin, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
Doing well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Colin, what is on the agenda today?
Well, I actually just had a quick conversation with Premier Doug Ford in the halls of Queen's Park here, and he told me that there were at least three items that he wants to raise and a potential fourth one as well. The main item is the Canada Health Transfer. So the federal government has been holding health care transfers to about 22% to all of the provinces. And the provinces really have wanted more money out of the federal government to the tune of about 35%. In terms of what their yearly budgets are. So they want, you know, billions of dollars more, about, you know, $25 to $30 billion additional. $10 billion of that would come to Ontario. So the premier has been touting this for the last 4 years, that Ontario and other provinces need a bigger share of the healthcare pie coming from the federal government. And so what better way to kind of make that case than to do it directly with the prime minister himself? And so that's, you know, the number one thing the premier told me that he's going to be raising. The second one is going to be about affordable housing. I'm not sure exactly what the premier is looking to do here, but, you know, every level of government has been talking about affordable housing recently, thanks to, you know, the red-hot housing market. The prime minister, as you mentioned, was in Kitchener today. He was making an announcement to spend $2 billion to help build 17,000 homes across the country. So that's obviously not enough to help solve any issue in Ontario. So, but that's one of the issues that the premier wants to talk to him about. Then the third one is infrastructure and immigration. The premier kind of indicated to me that, you know, the cost of certain items in terms of building materials is going up, and so they're looking to have a conversation about that. And immigration as well. Currently, Ontario is trying to have a larger share of immigrants that it can directly select. So, you know, every province has these streams that you apply to if you want to immigrate to Ontario. I want to apply to the healthcare stream, or I want to apply to a skills trade stream. And the province wants greater say over how many of those applicants it can allow into the province versus just generally having the federal government pick and choose who comes in. So those are the four main topics of conversation that are going to be coming up today.
When would this have been planned, Colin? Was this something that was planned in the past, or did it just come up this week? It seems to have fallen in everyone's lap.
Well, we kind of found out about it yesterday, but, you know, these things can sometimes be a little bit organic. Like if the prime minister, you know, happened to be in town to make an announcement in Kitchener, then perhaps they say, okay, let's, you know, have a meeting with the premier. But also on top of that, you know, there has to be an ideological overlap here for these two to meet. The last time the prime minister actually came to Queen's Park was back in 2018. That was his first and really only time coming to Queen's Park other than today. Now, the premier has gone to Ottawa a few times to meet with the prime minister at, you know, at his office. And ever since the pandemic, the prime minister and the premier really have been thick as thieves. In fact, just before the election campaign, the prime minister made a pretty big automotive announcement with the premier, and not with the Ontario Liberals, and they were quite miffed about that. So the relationship has changed, and this signifies, you know, maybe a turning of the page. They're no longer, you know, enemies. They're more friends with some common objectives in mind, and they feel like they can get more done by working together.
So it's fascinating to listen to what you're just describing as this relationship and how it's evolved and how at least they do seem to be working together. And thank goodness for that. When will we find out more about the health care? Is there any sort of agenda to talk to any of the reporters or so on about any of this?
Yeah, the premier is going to be speaking with journalists right after this meeting happens. So that should be perhaps at about 5 o'clock this afternoon. The prime minister apparently is not going to be taking questions from reporters about this meeting specifically. But we'll hear a little bit more from the premier. I mean, the big question to all of these is, you know, when premiers and prime ministers meet, what's the actual product here? What do we actually see as a result of these meetings? And you know, more often than not, it's nothing. You know, you're not actually going to see some big joint announcement coming out of it today. And if there was some kind of a joint announcement, they would have hammered out the details weeks ago with their staff, and they would have just been here to make this announcement. This is just more of a, you know, friendly meet and greet to raise issues, to talk about issues. And for the premier, perhaps to just slowly keep chipping away at this one issue of the Canada Health transfer. The premier might be under no illusions that he's not going to get a deal today, but, you know, maybe this is the conversation that leads to opening up the door to increased health care transfers from the federal government. So I think that's what they might be banking on.
Healthcare certainly top of mind for a lot of Canadians right now, that's for sure. Colin DeMello, Queen's Park Bureau Chief with Global News. Make sure you're watching Global Tonight for more on all of this. Colin, as always, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
Now, if you listen to the show, you know I love the polls. I love the surveys. I love to gauge where Canada's heads at, where Canadians' heads are at, especially during a global pandemic. I mean, it's been a very bizarre 2.5 years, to say the least. Well, Polaris Strategic Insights has launched a new monthly rage index. You're talking about rage index and Canada in the same sentence. Does that seem right? No, you go first. No, you go first. No, please, you go first. No, 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 no. You go first. I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry. Really, I'm sorry. Yeah, and in its inaugural survey, 83% of respondents feel angry about inflation, 79% about gas, 2/3 still on the Freedom Convoy, more than half, 57% about airport delays. That's just a peek. Let's bring in Dan Arnold, Chief Strategy Officer, Polaris, and with us now. Dan, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
I'm, unlike most Canadians, I'm not angry. I'm in a good mood and happy to chat here.
Oh, man. Are you surprised? Because, again, like I fooled in the intro there, normally we're known to be very polite people. Are you surprised we're so angry? Have you ever seen this before?
Yeah, I mean, Canadians usually keep their anger on the ice. You know, it's not something that you would necessarily associate with Canadians. I think that's why we kind of wanted to do this poll here, was because at the start of the summer, there was a sense that, you know, coming out of the pandemic, everything's going to be great. People are going to be in a great mood. It's going to be an amazing summer. But pretty much every barbecue myself or my Polaris colleagues were at this summer, people were complaining about the cost of bacon or about airport delays or passport renewals or something. So we felt that it was, you know, important to quantify this and actually see what the level of anger is out there. Because it certainly, you know, anecdotally at least, seemed like Canadians were in a grumpy mood. And that's basically what the poll results back up.
Oh, now you've got lots of results that show that. Let me ask you this question, Dan. Is this for everyone? I mean, because, you know, sometimes politicians and such will try to gauge it towards certain groups or segments of the population, and even now gender. But it appears that everyone's a little cranky right now.
Yeah, we really see this coast to coast. I mean, there's some differences. You know, it's a little bit more anger in the prairie provinces, a little bit less in Quebec. You know, men and women was interesting. The overall rage index score is the same for men and women, but very different things that they're angry about. Men are much more angry towards government, about some of these delays at airports, whereas women are really getting upset right now by the economic situation, the things like inflation, housing prices. So, you know, different things for different Canadians in terms of what gets you upset. But you know, it seems like everybody right now has got something that is at least getting under their skin.
You know, polling companies, research companies, they cover a lot of things. Did you ever think we would end up, or you would end up introducing a rage index?
No, I mean, it's something you would think would be coming out of U.S. Polling more so than in Canada. And just you know, just last week, I actually saw a poll in the U.S. that was asking about, you know, do you think that the U.S. is going to descend into civil war? And I hope we don't have to ask that question in Canada anytime in the near future. But, you know, it certainly seems like, you know, some of the frustration that we've seen in other countries is certainly spreading to Canada. And, you know, coming out of COVID, I think, you know, there's a year or two where everybody was kind of in this, you know, we're all in this together mentality. We're going to rally behind the flag. We're going to put these petty squabbles aside. But I think now that things are a little bit outside of that mentality now, all these frustrations that have been sort of bubbling for the last year or two are, you know, coming to the surface now. And, you know, we're seeing, you know, even over the weekend with the Deputy Prime Minister getting, you know, verbally assaulted in Alberta there, more and more of these incidences where, you know, it goes from just annoyance to much more visceral, you know, examples of anger.
And again, you know, when that happens, here we go. The extremes speak up on both sides and look what they've done. Oh, look what they've done. Look what they've done. Is anyone asking why, Dan? Is anybody asking why people are angry? Why, you know, what happened to the sunny ways?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, part of the reason for the polling here is to figure out what specifically is making people angry. I think the why is a little bit more challenging. I do think some of it is that, you know, there's a lot of frustration from the last couple of years during COVID, and now that we're out of it, or at least maybe partly coming out of it, but not in a great D-Day type moment where there's a big celebration and everything is back to normal. There's still a lot of things that are causing people troubles. And I think, you know, inflation obviously puts economic pressures on everybody. You know, it's one thing if you, you know, airport delays impact some people, but everybody is buying groceries or filling up their tank at the gas station. And I think when things like that go bad, it becomes a stress point for everybody. And you talk about it with your friends and it kind of builds because you just hear everyone else complaining and then you start complaining and it just sort of becomes a little cyclical there on some of these issues.
I was kind of surprised over the Freedom Convoy thing that this was still top of mind, nearly two-thirds for a lot of Canadians. Can you elaborate on that in any way?
Yeah, that was, I mean, after inflation and gas prices, that was the highest one on the index, and actually one that had a lot of people very angry. There was still 40% who said they were very angry about that even 6 months later. So, you know, I think that becomes a bit of a proxy issue for some of these pressures that have built up during COVID. I mean, the convoy itself was obviously an example of people who are very angry, you know, voicing that anger. But I think in the process of doing that, that kind of triggered people on the other side of this who maybe have been frustrated by other Canadians who weren't following masking guidelines or weren't getting vaccinated and causing, you know, the pandemic to spread as a result of that. So I think that becomes a bit of a focal point for, you know, everybody else on the other side who had been frustrated for one thing or another over the past couple of years to really kind of let their anger get out towards the convoy there. And, you know, even, you know, like you said, even 5 or 6 months later, it's still something that seems to be a bit of a flashpoint there for a lot of Canadians.
So this is concern on both sides of this issue. It's not necessarily anger at the Freedom Convoy. It's just the whole issue, whether you're on this side or that side of it. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that's probably fair to say. It's clearly an issue that engenders strong feelings, no matter where you're looking at it from.
I was reading a thing recently, and again, everybody's talking about this. Everybody's trying to figure out how to fix it, and what we do, what we can do to bring polarized people together and unite and such. I heard one discussion that said that politicians are not listening to Canadians. They're not listening. They're following their own agendas. They're not necessarily listening to the plight of Canadians. I know you didn't cover that, but are you sensing that in your research?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of anger out there towards both the federal and provincial governments in the country right now. You've got 48% of Canadians who are at least annoyed or moderately angry towards the federal government, and 46%, almost the same percentage, towards their provincial governments. So, yeah, you know, clearly there is that sense there that, you know, things are not going great in the halls of power across the country, and there is a lot of frustration among Canadians. And I think, you know, part of the reason we do research like this is, again, to shine a spotlight for everyone, including political leaders, to look at data and see, you know, what is it that Canadians are angry about? And, you know, hopefully they take the cue from that and, you know, take some steps to try to address those areas that are causing the most you know, most frustration and the most anger among Canadians, because I think, you know, political leaders who are in touch with what people are going through and how they're feeling are probably the ones who are the most successful, generally speaking. So hopefully a little bit more of a spotlight on a few of these pressure points that Canadians are facing might encourage a few more to take action where they can on these topics.
Fascinating discussion. Dan Arnold with us, Chief Strategy Officer Polara, talking about their rage index. And yes, they're referring to Canadians. We have to work on that. Dan, thanks so much for the time. Fascinating stuff. Be well.
Thanks.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
We were talking yesterday about the beer store now has more than 250 locations on Skip the Dishes after expanding its pandemic pilot project. Another example of how a global pandemic has changed the way we do things. Let's bring in Ozzy Ahmed, Vice President Retail, the beer store, in with us now. Ozzy, thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well.
Absolutely. Thanks, Scott, for having me. Super, super excited to be here. To speak to our partnership with Skip the Dishes and the beer store. So, yeah, thank you for having me.
So talk about the pilot project. Did this all come about as a result of the pandemic?
Definitely, that's part of it. But we're always looking for ways to better serve our customers. And I know through the pandemic, we looked at different ways of how we can connect with customers and get beer out to customers that couldn't make it. So this has been something that we've been working on for some time. And simply our goal with this program is to provide customers access to more than, you know, 1,000 brands and ease of shopping and you know, through the Skip app. And you know, basically it's like cold beer delivered right to your front door fast. And how great is that, right, Scott?
No disagreement from here. What about cost? Would it be the same as any food or whatever? How do you arrive at the cost? How much extra does it cost to get this feature?
Yeah, that's a great question, Scott. So the cost is actually the exact same. So whatever you buy for in the store is the same as you pay for online through the Skip app. Of course, there's a delivery charge and there's an alcohol handling fee, but the cost of the product is exactly the same.
And what does that depend on? How can you give us a rough idea of cost, or does that depend on where you're going, how far, that sort of thing?
Yeah, no, it does depend on where you're going. So location plays a factor, but the delivery is about four, give or take $4 to $7. So it's very reasonable.
So, I know that whether it's the LCBO or it's the beer store or whether it's hospitality, they've been looking for years to try to loosen up a bit of the stranglehold that Ontario seems to have on these industries. And obviously, during the pandemic, things have opened up quite a bit. Do you think was it moving towards this anyway, or how much has the pandemic sped up this sort of thinking?
It definitely has spread up. I think there's a lot of consumers who've gone to like a digital or online shopping experience, and I think they've enjoyed it. And when we're in the pandemic, I know everyone was looking at ways to, ways to kind of modernize and engage people in different ways. So it definitely, I think, accelerated, just like remote working. You know, 3 years ago, who would have thought that would have been, you know, common goal or common practice? But same thing with e-com and third-party delivery. I think that's definitely helped accelerate things for sure.
Are you surprised that this got approval? Because again, a lot of the times government makes it very difficult to jump through these hoops. Any challenges there?
I know for years, we've definitely kind of, you know, had conversations, and I mean, this is something that we've advocated for, and we're very pleased that we're in a position where the government's allowed this to happen. And I think they see that providing access through third party convenience is important. And, we're aligned with the government and we're supportive of their direction. We're grateful that we're allowed to do this and provide this convenience to customers. So it's a win-win situation for sure.
I remember at one time it was, you know, don't expose people to it. Don't make it easier for people to get their hands on it. The whole debate about grocery stores and such. Did you get any blowback from this? People saying, no, this is making it too easy for people to get their hands on the product.
No, not at all. So, I mean, responsible sale is a cornerstone of what we do. I mean, it's so important to us. It's our core value. We do not sell to minors and we do not sell to intoxicated people. And what I love about Skip is that they have that same high standard. So their drivers are smart certified. They believe in responsible sales. So, it's an extension of who we are, and they've done such a great job. And honestly, Scott, we piloted with, you know, a handful of stores across the province. Customers absolutely love it. Our employees love it. Everyone's happy. And You know, people are getting their beer fast within like 30, 35 minutes. So under, you know, under the 45 minute threshold, they're getting fast delivery. And, you know, customers, I always tell, vote through their dollars. And they've been definitely coming back to that Skip app and ordering again and again. So we've had, you know, really positive feedback. And we've had, yeah, we just, you know, like I said, customers and employees love it. And it's just a great convenience to have.
So, again, just to point out, Ozzy, the drivers pretty much undergo the same training as somebody who would a server. They're going through the same sort of certification process. So there's no link, no loss in the link there.
Exactly, right? So, we're, like I said, we hold responsible. So right from the beginning of the transaction, when our employees, you know, build the order to when it shows up at the door. And if someone is, you know, can't prove age of majority or is intoxicated, the sales refuse, the product's brought back. And that's the right thing to do. So we're, like I said, responsible sales, so important, is our core value. It's on our shirts. We have it on our shirts. It says we ID. That's how much we believe in it. So, you know, that partner that we aligned with, in this case is Skip, they have to have that same high degree of accountability, and they do. And so I feel like, you know what, it's executed exceptionally well.
Certain locations at this point, when are you looking at more? Are you?
Well, I mean, for the Hammer, I can, you know, I'm proud to say that every location in the Hammer and Stony Creek and Dundas all have Skip availability. So I'm really pleased to say that. So we're at 253 stores. We've rapidly expanded, and we're definitely going to look to continue to move forward. As you know, it's going to be based on what customers tell us, right? If customers love the platform, which from everything we're seeing, they do. We're definitely looking at expanding and providing that service to other stores in the province as well.
Ozzy Ahmed with us, Vice President of Retail. The Beer Store now has more than 250 locations on Skip the Dishes and plenty in this area. Ozzy, thanks for the time. Good luck with this. Be well.
Thanks, Scott. All the best. Take care.
Hard to believe, tomorrow marks the 25th anniversary of the death of Princess Diana. And I don't know if you remember much about that way back when, or if you're old enough to, I am. And the big issue at the time was the paparazzi. Princess Diana and her beau at the time were fleeing paparazzi who were chasing them all over the place because the princess was leading her own life at this time, had left Prince Charles, and wherever she was going was always a big story. And they were literally fleeing the paparazzi when they had this horrific car crash in France, and that took the life of both of them. Have things changed in that respect? Have we learned from the death of Princess Diana? Alyssa Freeman with us, PR and pop culture expert. She's here now. Alyssa, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
I am, and that was a very apt song. I was hoping that that was the lead into our segment, Scott.
I remember this was a big issue way back when, the paparazzi. We don't seem to be talking about it as much. Does that mean we've learned from it?
I think that Princess Diana's death definitely was a warning of how close paparazzi and how dangerous it can be. You know what, Scott? I also think that we as a society have become so used to paparazzi. We know what their job is. We actually feed on their photos. We look for photos now in ways that we probably didn't look for them before, thanks to all the social media platforms. So the thirst for pictures has not really gone away.
But you do bring up a very valid point with social media and the rise of that, and everybody now having a state-of-the-art phone or camera in their phone. Now those pictures are virtually everywhere. I guess does this group of people need to go chasing anymore when virtually everyone's a reporter?
I think the paparazzi probably still have their place because they still have access where we don't have access, such as at award shows. Mm-hmm. And paparazzi do work for publications that need to feed the beast, Scott. They need to feed it 24/7, because if you are on a gossip site or you're feeding it towards a particular magazine where you're always updating information and pictures, that's what feeds the beast. And people love pictures. You know, people don't love reading. I mean, some people do, but the long form article is not as in vogue as it used to be. Right now, if you can get a picture with a cut line, well, sometimes that serves as an entire person's news cycle on a particular issue. So I don't think it's gone away. I think it's basically actually diversified and has had to be dispersed among many platforms because there's so many ways that we get our news now.
How do we look at this whole incident now, 25 years later?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, I'm a royal watcher, Scott. I read the gossip.
That's why we've got you here, Alyssa.
That's why I'm here. And I think that there's a lot of questions as to what really happened that have been not answered or have been answered in a roundabout way. And I don't think we'll ever really find out what really happened. I think that the paparazzi were, you know, were they just a convenient excuse for what really happened? So I think that what we do remember is that, you know, think about it. When Princess Diana, even before she became a princess, before she married Prince Charles, she really was starting to become one of the most photographed women in the world. And then when she became a princess, it was relentless. We saw her going to the gym. We saw her in the gym. We saw people putting cameras in the ceiling. It almost feels odd that she is not with us anymore because of the immense photographic record. And I think what people remember about Princess Diana now is, yes, she had her faults. And, you know, yes, we won't agree with everything that that she did. But, you know, she stood for a lot of great things. She was the first person to touch someone publicly with the paparazzi there who had AIDS.
Yeah.
She supported, you know, the minefields by walking through minefields. You know, she did a lot of things, and she was really the first royal that helped us identify that not only is she a princess, but she's also a mother. So I think that there's a lot of things during the time when Princess Diana was alive that made us actually look at royals differently. And the only way we knew that, Scott, was by the pictures that were posted.
When all of this happened, or after it all happened, the tide turned for Prince Charles. People turned against him, especially his now wife, Camilla. Has that changed?
Yeah, I think it has. I mean, at first, you remember what they used to call her? The Rottweiler.
Yeah.
The British press went after them with a vengeance. But you know what? It seems that time heals all wounds, Scott. I won't say that Prince Charles is probably the most popular royal, but I think that sentiment towards him and Camilla has softened. You know, they televised their wedding. We saw it on TV. We felt that the family came together for it and everybody was happy with it. And you know, the Queen even said that when the day comes, when Charles becomes king, Camilla will be queen consort. And I never thought we would ever see the day, given how that whole relationship transpired. But you know what? Over time, people aren't as vengeful, and people tend to have a bit of a softer edge to them. And I think that they've accepted who he is and who he is with.
What about Harry and Meghan, since they left the royal family? And again, tired of the intrusion, much the same with Princess Diana. So is it still there?
Of course it's still there, but I still think that they court it in a way. I think that they pick and choose their times. You know, I'm reading an article right now that was probably an exclusive to People magazine. So I think that while the, you know, Prince Harry and Meghan have disavowed their royal the royalness, they still play up on it. And they may not do their duties, but they still sort of play up on that lineage. It will never ever go away for Prince Harry. And you know, there was a lot of vilification of Meghan in the press, and you know, whatever I may feel about her, it doesn't really matter. But I mean, I think that they're working hard to overcome that and just be seen as two people who want to support worthy causes. And that's an uphill climb, Scott. That's an uphill climb, because while you're trying to do good, you know, the mainstream media and social media and, you know, regular people like, you know, you and me who post on social media will always have something to say about that. So it's not really ever a win-win situation. But I think that as they continue their lives and as they continue to grow into their lives with their children and their projects, we too may soften towards Meghan Markle.
Alyssa Freeman with us, PR and pop culture expert. Tomorrow, hard to believe, marking the 25th anniversary of the death of Princess Diana. Alyssa, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
We've been talking a lot about Bell Media this week and the firing of Lisa LaFlemme, one of Canada's favorite newscasters. And with just the way the whole thing was handled and the lack of information, nobody really knowing what happened. It was really just a business decision, as they say, in these sorts of things. Then all of a sudden the discussion turned to one of ageism and going gray on the air, and then the double standard with male and female anchors and such. So where is this going, and how does this brand recover from this moving forward? What can we all learn from this? I'm sure it is a discussion in many business classes. Let's bring in Marvin Ryder, professor at DeGroote School of Business, McMaster University. He's with us now. Marvin, thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well.
I'm great, thank you. Glad to be with you.
I haven't talked to you about this, Marvin. What is your first reaction when you first take note of what has happened and the way it's been handled? Obviously, Lisa LaFlemme get let go, and now the person that made that decision is on leave, and there's an internal investigation going on in regard to their newsroom. What's your take on all of this?
Well, I'm confused, frankly. I'm confused. So let me go through a couple of the things you just said. Standard operating procedure in something like this that hits the headlines is the idea of calling for an internal review. So full marks, good idea. Make sure it's transparent. Make sure you share the results and act swiftly. But here's the problem. This is the third review conducted at CTV News in the last 3 years. Now, one of them was focused more on CP24, sort of a sister operation. And that also involved Mr. Melling. This is the man who was Lisa LaFlemme's boss. So there was one review involving him. There was another review at CTV News. And now we've got the third review. Reviews are great, but they're only good if they do something. So there's my first problem. Problem number two, Mr. Melling's boss, Mr. Bibich, has come out and said, I have reviewed the situation, and I can assure you that Lisa LaFlemme was not let go due to ageism, sexism, or gray hair. And I go, good, glad to hear it. Those would be terrible reasons to let her go. But you may have noticed Mr. Bibich didn't say why she was let go. If it's, mm-hmm. Are you saving money? Was she getting too expensive? What led to it? So we know why she wasn't fired, but we don't know why she was fired. And then the third thing is even Mr. Melling himself, he issued a release that said, I'm taking a leave to be with my family and focus and refocus. And okay, I get it. Mr. Bibich said that he's on leave pending the outcome of the review, meaning conceivably the review could exonerate him and Mr. Melling would be back. So I'm just confused. I don't still to this day know why Lisa LaFlemme was let go, and therefore we don't know of any of these other allegations. Their argument, by the way, CTV's argument, is that in the severance package that they're giving Ms. LaFlemme, they're prohibited from revealing a lot of things. So, you know, isn't that convenient too?
And does this all now go back to the lesson learned here? If you don't give some sort of storyline, if you don't explain what happened, the public will then create their own, whether it's ageism, sexism, color of hair, what have you.
Absolutely. And, you know, the media, Scott, and in a sense, you are an example of it. I guess I'm a little example of this, too. We come into people's homes and we sort of become a member of the family. And when you decide to change that for whatever reason, you need to let them know what's going on there and what's happening. You know, let me just give you a terrible example. Suppose Lisa LaFlemme did something terrible. Suppose she sexually harassed somebody and you go, oh, my gosh, that seems so out of character for Lisa. But oh, if she did that, well, now I understand why you had to let her go. When you just let her go, you've got to have your rationale, especially in something high profile. This would be the same way in politics. If Justin Trudeau were to suddenly remove a senior cabinet minister with no explanation at all, then we'd invent one. So, you know, we always have to be aware of these people and their status in the community. And I think the people in general want to have a reason for these things, and we just still don't have one.
But normally, prior to the pandemic, a business decision was a good enough reason. And usually what that meant is money or a changing and a changing landscape. So is this about the above, ageism, gender, hair color, or is this about money and a changing landscape that the company refused to address?
Right, right. So again, let me just say it back to you in that simplest way possible. If they had said, ladies and gentlemen, Lisa LaFlamme is now getting paid $1 million a year, we think that's too much given the revenues we've got, and for cost-saving measures, we're letting her go. Okay, we'd understand. We might not like it, but we would understand that was your business rationale for this. If you don't give a rationale, then we pick on something like the fact that she hasn't been coloring her hair. Now, my problem with that argument is that that happened about a year and a half ago when we declared hairstyling salons as non-essential businesses. Lisa wasn't able to professionally get her hair touched up. So she said, okay, I'm just going to let it go natural. Years and years and years ago, Bob Barker did the same thing on The Price is Right. After a hospital stay, he wasn't able to get it done. And people said, you know what? We like the gray. So, you know, if it was because she went gray, then the time to have let her go was a year and a half ago, not a year and a half later after we'd all gotten used to that as her sort of new standard hair color. So this is the thing. If, whatever your rationale, whether it's trivial or important, you should share it. And if you don't, then we're going to fill the void with whatever we think is the right answer.
So how does Bell get out of this?
Well, again, I think it's pretty easy here, transparency. You've got to say to people, okay, what was the rationale? Now, if you now look at it and say we had a bad rationale, oh my gosh, we got rid of Lisa because she added 5 pounds to her figure during COVID or whatever it is, then hire her back. Oops, we made a mistake. Pay for it. If you have to give her a raise, pay for it. Fire Mr. Melling, get behind it. If there is a good reason, however, then you've got to get that story out there too. Otherwise, you're going to lose the PR war. And there are alternatives. Again, Scott, let me just be very blunt here. You work for an alternative. That's Global News. In other words, CBC News. Viewers have choices. And if you do not clarify this for them, they will take their business elsewhere. And losing those eyeballs, especially today in the world of mass media, that may be something that really hurts your bottom line. So you've got to come out with your story, and either it's a good story and we'll all say, oh, well, now that we know, great decision on your part. Or if it's a terrible story, reverse it, admit you made a mistake and move on. But leaving it like this is just going to be chewing you away for the next 2 or 3 months.
All right, Marvin Ryder with us, professor at DeGroote School of Business, McMaster University, the Bell brand, and what they've got to do to move it forward and get out of the quagmire that they are in surrounding Lisa LaFlamme. Do you think this would have happened? Do you think there'd be this much attention paid to this if this was happening maybe 3 years ago prior to the pandemic?
Good question. I think we've all, over these last couple of years, become more attuned to our media, and we need them more than ever for as news sources. It's been a turbulent couple of years. We need to know what's going on, whether it's with COVID or now monkeypox, other things like that. So we brought more people into our family, and we really, really do appreciate them. And then when you do this upheaval, I think you're going to miss them more than you would have 2 or 3 years ago. So I think this is actually a good news story for CTV. People were watching this newscast. It was the number one news or an evening news broadcast out there. And when you make a change like this, it just really resonates with people. Would have resonated a few years ago, but even more now post-COVID.
Marvin Ryder, professor at DeGroote School of Business, McMaster University. Thank you, Marvin. Be well.
I will. Take care.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
We're going to bring in Ian Lee, Associate Professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University, to talk about Russia and Starbucks and McDonald's and such leaving and them just kind of spinning off a similar product and relaunching it there. But oddly enough, as we're opening up this interview, we're getting news that Mikhail Gorbachev, former leader of the Soviet Union, has passed away at the age of 91. Ian Lee, Associate Professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton, with us now. Ian, thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well.
My pleasure, Scott. Doing very well, thanks.
Ian, would it not have been around the time of Gorbachev when McDonald's and all these companies started showing up?
Yes. They actually showed up a little bit before. In fact, President Cohan, as he's of McDonald's Canada at the time, I'm talking back in the early 90s, wrote a book about McDonald's going to Russia, and it was McDonald's Canada, not McDonald's U.S. People would say there's no difference, but there was because McDonald's U.S. Chicago world headquarters, did not want to touch Russia with a 10-foot pole back in the 80s during communist times. So they gave a carte blanche, basically, to Mr. Cohen to explore it on his own. He did, and he wrote a book about it called To Russia with Flies, real quite a clever title, you know, a spinoff of the James Bond movie title. And but that's really a distinction without a difference, except to give Canadians some credit. And it was really under Gorbachev that the whole perestroika in Glasnost, which was opening and transparency, occurred. And Gorbachev will go down in history and as the man who ended the Cold War. After 71 years of communism collapsed, and Gorbachev allowed it to collapse. He didn't try and use the military, as previous leaders of Soviet Union had done, invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968, invasion of Hungary in 1950, I think it was 9. They used force, and brutal force, to keep everyone under the communist thumb. When there was an uprising under Gorbachev's time, he said, no, I'm not sending in the military into Poland or elsewhere. And so he will get the credit for ending the Soviet Union, the very end or the termination that Putin today says was a catastrophic geopolitical mistake. So you can see there's very strongly different views there. But Gorbachev will get the credit for, as I said, ending the Soviet Union as we know it. And then that led on to all the problems that have occurred since. What do you replace it with? And then they struggled under Yeltsin, and then they finally came up with this autocrat killer called Putin, who has run Russia with increasingly draconian hand since then.
I was going to ask you how the leadership has changed, but obviously you've just explained that. Now that Gorby has passed on, is his era reflected in Russia? Those were times of, times of inspiration, times of vision, whereas now it appears they're going backwards. Will this carry any significance, do you think?
Yes and no. I mean, there's been a big debate about this and everything I'm reading. Of course, I'm reading in translation. I don't read Russian. I don't speak Russian. I've taught there. I've been to Russia. I've been many, many times to Ukraine. This was in the 90s, mostly. I've been fascinated by it because of that whole period of history and the confrontation between East and West. But to your point, very quickly, my read of everything I've read is that Gorbachev became persona non grata. He was widely reviled because he ended the Soviet Union, and there was great nostalgia amongst many Russian-speaking people for that period because they felt they'd been humiliated by the collapse of the Soviet Union. And this narrative was certainly promoted throughout the past 20 years by Mr. Putin. And it was a very successful narrative from everything I've read in The Economist, which is very prestigious, The New York Times. I mean, there was wide reporting that Putin's narrative, that Gorbachev screwed it all up, a terrible event, was the accurate interpretation. However, Putin, as we all know, did what he did 3 or 4 months ago, and I think it's fair to say, without any sense of exaggeration, that Putin's brand is in deep, deep strategic decline. More and more Russia, there's more and more reporting that the Russian elites, the Russian military, the Russian oligarchs are blaming Putin privately, for the catastrophic invasion. They thought it was going to be a cakewalk, 3 days they were going to conquer the country, and now they're in this quagmire, and they're actually calling it a quagmire. And they said, apparently it was reported in the Telegraph only 2 days ago that the military have told Putin he has no good options left other than a humiliating retreat, shades of the U.S. and Vietnam in the very late 60s, early 70s. And this is going to destroy Putin's reputation. So what I'm trying to say, Scott, is the story is not yet over. We don't yet know how Russians are going to what they're going to think about this for another 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years, because Gorbachev just died. He destroyed, brought the Soviet Union to an end. But one could argue that Russia, Putin, is really destroying or bringing to an end the reforms that he put in place after Gorbachev. And so what's going to replace him? I mean, Putin, when he passes from the scene. And nobody knows the answer yet. So I think the story is not yet finished.
Mikhail Gorbachev, final Soviet leader, ended the Cold War, dies at 91. So as a result, we never even got to talk about Starbucks and McDonald's and the spinoffs and knockoffs and such. And as Ian said, it's ever-changing. Ian Lee, Associate Professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University. Fascinating discussion, Ian. Thanks for the time. Be well.
Thanks very much, Scott. Great talking.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
Christia.
Yes.
What the f*** are you doing in Alberta? You f***. Traitors. Get the f*** out of this province.
You don't belong here.
You're a f***. Traitor. You f***.
Yeah, go ahead and hide.
All right, guys. You got a traitor in the f*** elevator. Don't touch me. Go.
We are leaving.
Do not touch me.
We are leaving.
Do you love that? Do you love her? Do you love Christia Freeland?
No.
I f*** will not. Don't tell me to get. I'll walk out my own power, okay? So back off.
Just
f*** back off. I know this gentleman here.
Okay.
Country shouldn't even be allowed in Alberta. She's destroying this country. Your kids are going to have no future. Okay? I hope you get it. Somebody's got to get it. Because we're the only ones fighting for this country right now. And it sure as hell isn't her.
There you have it. Will Weber spinning the clip of what happened in Alberta a few days ago. Christia Freeland harassed, and you heard it, the barrage of insults coming at her from an Albertan who was upset with her politics. Obviously, you want to condemn anything like this. Nobody deserves to be treated like this. You certainly have the right to, you know, to voice your public approval or disapproval, but this is taking it one step too far. That being said, it certainly is not an isolated incident. We've certainly seen it happen and increase over the years, whether it's male or female. I'm not sure, you know, perhaps there's more reports from women experiencing this. I think this reaction would have been the same whether it was Christia Freeland or Justin Trudeau who was getting on that elevator, although it certainly appears that women are getting harassed more than men are in the field. Let's bring in Sean Sparling, retired deputy chief of Sault Ste. Marie Police, currently the president of Investigative Solutions Network, and with us now. Sean, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
Yeah, you too. Thank you for having me.
So, what are your thoughts on this incident that happened? Is it time for Canadian politicians to re-examine their security?
Yeah, I think absolutely it is time. I actually commented on it yesterday with my family when I saw that that clip with Christia Freeland. It's unbelievable how polarized things have become, and really in today's day and age that you have such a high-profile political figure such as the Deputy Prime Minister of Canada that is not being escorted by security detail with threat risk assessments and whatnot. It's unfortunate, but it's the reality, but it's quite shocking that it hasn't already come to that.
Do you think this will change things moving forward?
Absolutely, I think it will, and I hope it does. Again, it's unfortunate it has to, but you even look at over the United Kingdom just last year or whatever it was, There was the murder of a politician over there. And we're not far off the same type of society that there is in the UK. And you look at how polarized things have become. You just look at what happened in the convoys in Ottawa and everything else. And it's time to revisit our security for our national figures, for our politicians and whatnot. Absolutely, she should have a security detail with her.
Oddly enough, it was Christia Freeland who was talking to, I believe it was in regard to the trade discussions. She was talking to U.S. officials, and they were surprised she didn't have security detail, saying that she rode her bike to work. And, you know, we just don't live in that type of country, she said. What has changed? Are you surprised at that answer and that even before this attack that some don't feel the need for security?
Yeah, you know, I'm not surprised at her comments because I would agree with her up until a couple of years ago. Listen, it wasn't too long ago that I was in Ottawa myself and you walk right up to the apartment building right to the doors.
Yeah.
You can't do that in the United States. You can't walk right up to Congress. You can't walk right up to the White House, right? But things have changed, and it's the polarization of our politics, I think, is what's doing that. And so you're seeing that it's becoming more normalized for these people to have these confrontations such as this, and it's absolutely wrong, but it's unfortunate the reality that we're in, and we have to change with the times.
What does or would this security look like? Is it about, you know, having a lot of guys in suits walking around you? Is it about just somebody who's investigating from a security lens where you're going every day and what you're doing?
Well, in in Minister Freeland's example, I think what should happen with her is that there should be ongoing threat risk assessments, and the RCMP certainly have the ability to do that, and they have the VIP security teams available. She should have an escort, security escort to it that is laid on based on the threat risk assessment. And certainly people shouldn't have ready access to her in the lobby of a hotel in an elevator like that. That's a confined space. And nobody should be able to get that close to her in such a public setting like that.
There's one thing when you're out and about. There's another thing when you're at work or at home. What about at home?
Well, at home, they would do typically they'll do risk assessments of their home, like alarms and cameras and the posture of the property itself. And if need be, they would actually place security at her residence, like out in the driveway or on the property. Again, we're talking about the Deputy Prime Minister of Canada, the second highest position in our political structure. She needs some protection.
How do you decide who gets it, who doesn't? Does everybody get it? Is it only the select few that have higher profiles? How do you figure that out, Sean?
It goes back to the risk assessment. So the certainly our intelligence services and our law enforcement services, they'll be monitoring and tracking these people and whatnot. They'll have some pretty good intelligence on who's who out there. And it'll be best based on the risk assessment. There'll be certain positions that just automatically require, like the prime minister, deputy prime minister, remember the head of the opposition, those kind of positions, the governor general. They just by virtue of their positions, probably need some level of security. And the rest could be done on a kind of a risk assessment on a needed basis.
Sean Sparling with us, retired Deputy Chief, Sault Ste. Marie Police, currently President of Investigative Solutions Network, talking about the need to change the security protocol for politicians in this country. Sean, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thanks for your time.
Now, you might remember the discussion around the Line 5 pipeline, which Dan McTay will explain to you in just a minute. But it basically goes through Michigan and into Sarnia and such, carrying energy, natural gas, whatever, back and forth, oil back and forth. Now, the Canadian government is invoking for the second time in less than a year a treaty that will force the American government to negotiate the fate of Enbridge's Line 5 pipeline. Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly announced the treaty on Monday, pointing to the significant impact shutting down this pipeline would carry for Canadian jobs and such, and then goes on as if she's going to sell natural gas, which is very bizarre considering earlier this week, our prime minister is very well documented in saying he just doesn't see a business case for Canadian liquid natural gas. Yet he's going to court to fight to keep this pipeline open. That would seem like a pretty good business case to me. Let's bring in Dan McTagg, President of Canadians for Affordable Energy, a former Liberal MP, and with us now. Dan, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
Yes, got a lot to impartial there, and
Explain it to me, Dan. He says he doesn't see a business case for natural gas, yet he's fighting with the U.S. government, Michigan specifically, to keep a pipeline open. How is that not a business case for?
Well, I guess it comes down to splitting hairs, which he's very good at doing. But look, he's not a scientist. He doesn't know anything about energy. I know that because I still have the letter from 2010 where he wrote saying, you know your stuff on consular and consumer and energy issues, and we need you back in caucus. That's before he decided that there are other more prevailing issues like abortion that were far more important to him than anything else. So now we, of course, have a country where for the longest of time and up until really the last minute when Enbridge was basically saying it's do or die, did the federal government bother to, do a little stretch and finally write a letter? For 5 years, I had been warning in my previous work with U.S. Emergency officials who kept pleading with me to say, for God's sakes, get your government of Canada to wake up and smell the coffee. Michigan is going to shut you guys down. And it won't just hurt us, Michigan and Ohio and neighboring states as far away as Pennsylvania and even towards the other direction, Indiana, Illinois. It's going to hurt you Canadians. And smarten up, because it's not just about oil getting to your refineries, making petrochemicals, making gasoline, making jet fuel, making planes, automobiles go. It's also natural gas liquid, not liquid natural gas. Let's turn this around a little bit. That's propane, which
Okay.
Places like Quebec love and need, and the rest of us do, as does the Upper Peninsula in Michigan. So there we go. We have a government that has really provided two faces to the same equation.
Already invoked this treaty once. Why do we need to do it a second time?
Well, the treaty is paramount. The treaty is an obligation at the federal level between two countries that have agreed to maintaining pipelines that currently exist. Trudeau does not like new pipelines, but he wants to keep the old ones in place because he knows full well that even the wokesters who drive around their EVs need to have natural gas, need oil, because you can't make an EV without that. You can't make a solar panel. You can't make anything without fossil fuels. This is the irony, of course, of the Greens and the alarmists and, of course, their friends in Ottawa who think they can have it both ways. By the way, that's not working out very well in Europe. So what we're now seeing, we have a scenario that's playing out where the Prime Minister is having to use, you know, the nuclear option in ensuring that the Line 5 pipeline doesn't shut down, that no other state jumps in and joins in with Governor Whitner or her Attorney General, who's around a lot longer, Dana Nessel, and tries to pull the same stunt. But again, the Americans, like everyone else, is confused. A country with the third largest provable reserves of oil and gas in the world still can't make an argument that there's a business case for getting product to market and using pipelines. So, you know, it's confusion, not by them, but by us. Imagine being an outsider looking at the actions of this government, including the Germans, saying, what is your major malfunction, Canada? So, look, congratulations and kudos to all the dummies out there who voted for him and the NDP coalition that he's a part of.
Well, and again, this, and obviously, let's be honest, U.S. is a very friendly neighbor, unlike Russia to Germany and such. But this is the same sort of thing. It's dependence on other people to get your stuff. And then complaining, you know, your hands are clean, but theirs are dirty. You complain about that, but yet you're depending on them to deliver you energy.
Except that the United States killed the Keystone Pipeline, which would have brought them a lot more heavy oil, which they desperately need because there is a diesel crisis. Now, for trendies out there that don't think anything of it, look at the truck that's passing by delivering your woke coffees and donuts and other things that you like to eat. They're all delivered by trucks driven by diesel. There's a shortage, a critical shortage now of diesel in the world. So, yeah, I think the relationship between Canada is great, but it's conditional, and it's conditional not on that treaty that was signed in 1977. It's conditional on the two so-called progressive governments on both sides of the border waking up and smelling the proverbial coffee, because what they've done, certainly in the Canada's case, having as large the reserves that we have, having built out pipelines, having had 17 or 18 LNG projects scuppered by this federal, liberal, woke, green government, the world is asking, begging Canada to get back on track, smarten up, and get this energy to us, because the alternative is Russia. The alternative is a global, not just energy crisis, but now a very severe security crisis.
That's not going to be a problem, Dan, because there's going to be an alternative any day right now that's just going to replace it all. And believe me, I'm all for R&D and renewables and getting to the bottom of this. But, you know, shutting off the tap ain't going to make it happen any faster.
Germans spent $500 trillion and have got nowhere to show. Got nothing to show for it. So
I can't believe the predicament Germany has gotten themselves in after being a so-called leader in R&D in green renewable energy. That being said, where is this Michigan deal going? Because obviously this is the second time in less than a year that this has happened. So is it just a matter of time before it's shut off?
Well, it's a good. Someone's going to shut it off sooner or later, and it's going to happen by some court. But I mean, in the federal government are in a much stronger position because they've actually, in the case of the federal government, showed some interest in defending this, probably for good reason, because having 40-50% unemployment in Ontario would mean that even the most committed of liberal voters, cult voters, would still vote for the Liberals were it not for the fact that 30-40% of people might be out of work with this pipeline. It's that serious. You shut down your airports, Hamilton, shut down Toronto, you'd have to shut down most of your locomotives, you'd have to shut down your chemical sector, you'd shut down your propane, which is needed for industry, for tow motors and manufacturers. It would be a disaster. So I guess that's forced the hand of green alarmists and other bedwetters that this is a pipeline that you cannot do without, for which our economy is reliant and very heavily dependent upon.
And the Foreign Affairs Minister, Melanie Joly, in announcing this invocation of the treaty, called this a significant impact, shutting down the pipeline, killing Canadian jobs and bills. The economy and energy disruption and damage to Canada and the U.S. from a Line 5 shutdown would be widespread and significant. This would impact energy prices such as propane for heating homes and the price of gas at the pump. At a time with global inflation making it hard, this is unacceptable. This does not sound like the current government.
So why the hell did they kill, you know, the Energy East pipeline, the Northern Gateway pipeline? Why did they spike through regulations like C-48 and C-69, bills that were designed to make sure that we build no more pipelines in this country? Look, these folks have come a long way on the road of conversion in a little place called Damascus. We call this Ontario. But sooner or later, people are going to have to realize that Canada can no longer continue down this road of trying to play both sides, which is what the federal Liberal government has done. You either do your stuff or get off the pot, and that's as simple as that. You're for pipelines, for Canadian oil and gas, or you're for the destruction of the country, not just politically, but economically.
Dan McTagg, President of Canadians for Affordable Energy, former Liberal MP. As always, Dan, thanks for the time. Be well.
All the best. Thanks, Scott. Cheers.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
We've certainly heard the trial and tribulations of people going in and out of airports, and more specifically, trying to get a passport to even get to the airport. You got to wait for a passport, then you got to get to the airport and wait again. Over and above the normal procedure, obviously. There's actually a report yesterday saying things are improving, but not much to report other than that. So Will Erskine, content producer for Hamilton Today, on a search for a passport, and decided he was going to go out and do it today. And Will is with us now. Will, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
Well, I just got here. I ran from the place. I finally got finished, and I'm here in the building.
So first of all, where are you going? You need a passport.
So I'm going down to the States, actually, first time in several years, just for a bit of a family thing.
Nice.
Yeah. But kind of a little bit last minute. And so my passport fallen behind on that, so I needed to do the whole fast track it, which means you have to go to one of the locations that allows you to do that, and that means you got to end up camping out basically in the middle of the night, like you're waiting for a new Star Wars film.
So you got there early and lined up. What happened?
So I got there at I got up before 4 this morning. I got lined up around, I'd say, 5:30-ish or so, and that was running late by my schedule. There were already people there with their folding chairs, their blankets, and everything else. And they were set up. Now, one of the great things right from the start, though, people who had done this before have been leaving behind their folding chairs. There's some that are already provided by the Service Canada people, and then there's just people leaving their chairs because they know someone else is going to have to do this the next day.
Hey, feel free to use my tent. There it is. It's set up.
Exactly.
I can't believe it.
Exactly. And that was what struck me, was there's already a communal sense of humor about this. Everyone was in pretty good spirits because we were all sleep deprived and we were all going through this same experience. By the time the security guard comes out at, I don't know, I guess it was about 7 in the morning, which was still about another hour and a half before anything really got rolling. But the security guard comes out and kind of checks in with all of us, lets us know if we need to use the washroom, we can get in, and kind of gets everyone prepped for how it's going to go once the day starts going. Now, you know, people are showing up at 8 o'clock, and we've already got a line going almost around the corner of the building.
Man, so what time the doors open at 9?
The doors got opened at about 8:30. By then, we'd already had an employee come out who distributed little tickets to a few of us, to some of us. Not everyone in line got our ticket, where they were going to have to wait even longer. And the line got kind of broken up into the people who were there for, say, picking up their passport or doing something else, or people like me who were applying to get it put in gear. And yeah, doors eventually opened 8:30 and they start shuffling us in. And even then there were people still pulling up into the parking lot and going wide eyed when they saw the line. And I heard someone who in line with me who had tried this on Monday morning and found it was even worse. They had to come back and try it again today, and they finally got in the building. But once I got in, everything moved very smoothly. They've got at least a few months of practice now with dealing with the backlog. And I got in. I got actually in and out in about an hour.
Well, that's not bad, but you had to line up for several before getting in.
But you had to line up. If you want your chance at getting in, again, it's like the stories of friends of mine who camped out for Lord of the Rings movies and stuff like that. You got to show up at about... You got to show up at 4. I think that's what some of these people had done. If you want to be first in the door, you know?
So what time did you eventually get out? How did this end?
I got out at about 9:45. I got out the door and I headed across the road to the closest place that sells caffeine I could find. And I gave myself a copious amount to get myself moving for today's show.
So showed up at roughly 4:30-ish, got out at 9:45-ish.
That's about it.
Oh, man. And so do you have passport? What do you have to do now? Is it being mailed to you? What's the story?
I went with the pick it up at the location. That was kind of the nice middle path. It's gonna go pretty quickly. I didn't pay for the extra to get it done by the end of this week. I have a couple weeks, and it'll come in, and it'll be in with enough time for if there's any interruptions before I have to actually head down to the States.
Are you fearful that come the middle of September, you won't have it? Because we've heard lots of stories of people that, I've been waiting since April.
Yeah, I made them promise 3 times over and stop just short of a pinky swear.
There you go. All right, so it looks by the middle of the month you may get it.
I think so, and again, as I said, they're running pretty smoothly now. They've got enough practice with it, so I'm confident that it'll work. And again, it was a pretty jovial experience all around from everyone there.
All right, just get there early. Will Erskine with his content producer for Hamilton Today, in line to get his passport. Way to go, Will. Glad to see you're still upright, retaining fluids.
More or less.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, greatly appreciated. Thanks to the two Wills for producing, as well as Diana and Dave in the newsroom. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word.
Hello, Scott. My name's Connor, and with the Premier and the Prime Minister meeting today, let's just hope that instead of looking for a typical Band-Aid solution, they look for, at the very least, an atypical Band-Aid solution.
Yeah, baby.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.